Board. So we're going to have the Pledge of Allegiance. This is one of those clocks that, yes, it connects, you know, so it's accurate. I pledge allegiance
to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Will you do the roll call?
Commissioner Hartzell?
Here.
Commissioner First?
Here.
Commissioner Bushy?
Here.
Commissioner Gaffney?
Present.
And Commissioner DiGiovanni.
This is the time for open period for public participation. If someone wishes to address us on a matter that over which we have jurisdiction but is not on the agenda, speak now, please.
I just have one quick comment as the general manager, not public. But in the audience is Ken Spray, our new admin services manager.
Oh, he started
a couple
welcome.
Weeks ago.
All right.
Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you.
And I mentioned last month how Ken, he started the agency 1 year before me back in 1992.
A long time ago.
And he was here through 1999. Then he went to Vallejo Sanitation Flood Control, and he's come back to the CMSA.
Yes.
Welcome back.
Good. It's a wonderful organization. Very glad to be here.
I just I spent a couple days when we were on vacation with my husband's best man actually came to visit, and his work is organizational management.
Okay.
And he goes into corporations and agencies and deals with things that are going on. And I said, I have one. If you ever just wanted to visit it and talk to people, you would find yourself so happy at the end of the day because it's called Central Marine Sanitation. Bragging about us here. All right. Well, the consent calendar is before us. Does anyone desire to pull anything? Or
I will move to approve 4A through 4G.
Can I have one little question?
Certainly.
Just a question on 4B. Are we responsible for maintaining the road, Jason? You know, there's a payment to Majora and Gelati.
Yes, yes.
We are.
Oh no. So the city of Santa Fe has an easement through our property, and that's where Anderson Drive was constructed.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So what happened was during those major rain events in January, but that got the whole hillside saturated. Then the big events in February, there were several mudslides on the hill, and some of them were pretty close to, approaching Anderson Drive. So we contacted Majora and Gelati as an emergency matter. They brought in, they're really efficient too. Yeah. Within a couple hours of contacting them, hiring them on time and materials basis, of course account, they shut down a lane and put in the K rail, and they covered up all of the slide with plastic material. And they diverted the storm drain flow around the mudslides and stabilize it so that way the mud wouldn't flow on Anderson Drive.
So that's our property, right?
That's right.
Okay, yeah. That's what I didn't. I thought it was Santa Fe property.
But our property is all the way to the ridge on the hill.
Oh, it is. Okay.
Yeah.
And we abut, actually, Marin Sanitary Services property, correct?
Right in front of our gate. That's right. And state so property on the top of the hill.
We've worked with them on the homeless camps and removing the trash and debris and the encampments from time to time.
Yeah.
We work with, of course, Conservation Corps. That's not what it's called.
The Marin Conservation Corps.
It is, Marin Conservation Corps. And Marin Sanitary, we jointly...
Okay. Hmm. Okay, well, I second the motion.
Thank you.
Okay, the motion has been made and seconded to approve the consent calendar. All those in favor?
Aye.
Anyone opposed? All right. The next item on the agenda is the number 5. We've got California Water Environment Association awards. Jason?
Thank you, Charles. So CMSA is a member of the California Water and Environment Association, and there's 18 sections in the association around the state, and we're in the Redwood Empire section, which is all of, Marin County, Sonoma County, Napa County, a good portion of Solano County, and part of Mendocino County. So all the agents, wastewater agencies within that area are in the Redwood Empire section. So every May-June time frame, the section sends out a list of all the awards that they're going to have for that calendar year, then we take a look at the list and we make a determination which ones we think that we can compete in competition against other agencies within that section. So we got the list this year. We looked at it. We filled out a lot of applications. Then in December, we received notification that we had received 11 different awards. So at the December meeting, I presented that to the board, and we had all the plaques up here. So once, if you have someone that takes first place, either organizationally or individually, they then get elevated to the state level competition against the winners from the other 17, CWA sections throughout the state. So we received notification from the state level CWA that we had won some awards. So I listed here, there's first place, second place, and third place, and I'll just kind of read through these real quick. So our public education program, and this is the cooperative program that we have with Novato, San, Las Colinas, SASM, Sasol and Marin City, and Sanitary District Number 5, which is Tiburon, we won first place in the state for the public ed program. They changed the name from public education program to community engagement and outreach now. But so that regional program won first, so we were pretty excited about that. Then back in February, the safety committee for the state level came in and toured the agency, met with our safety director, and we won first place for a safety program of the year for organization that has 25 to 75 employees, so that we're excited about that also. And then one of our newer employees, John Farr, who's been with us for about a little over a year now, he received first place for electrical instrumentation person of the year. Then we have second place, so Gretchen Mueller, who's an environmental services analyst, and she kind of leads up that cooperative public ed program. She's the chair of that committee. She won second place for public education person of the year. Then, if you recall, a couple years ago, we worked with a professor from Cal State Fullerton on a biogas utilization study. So we applied for this research award based on that study that we didn't really assist with. We provide a lot of information and did a lot of sampling of the biogas, and the professor did, produce the study. But we received second place under the Research Achievement of the Year for the biogas study. And then a couple third place awards. One was for the treatment plant of the year, medium size. We were hoping for first place, of course, but others have to get that. And then third place for newsletter of the year. So we're happy about that. As you know, Kate designs the newsletter for us and does an exceptional job with that.
Thank you.
It's a good looking newsletter that we produce internally. No outside help with the newsletter, so that's a good thing.
It's
first place, that's right. It should have been first place.
Obviously, someone there.
Anyway, I just wanted to present this to the board because we were pretty excited about these state level awards.
Impressive.
So if you win a first place as an individual, you get a bonus, I guess.
Yeah. So we have an administrative policy that the board adopted several years ago. And under that administrative, it's called the Employee Award Recognition Policy. So it lists, award categories. There's, the NACWA Award for the peak performance, which we won't be getting, after this year. There's that, then there's the CWA, regional and state level awards, then CSRMA awards also. I think that's only three main categories. But for CWA state level awards, each individual award winner receives a $250 monetary award from the board. And then, for the organizational first place awards, every employee would receive $250. So the state safety program is covered under that category. Then the few employees that participate in the public ed program, they also receive $250.
What if you come in second or third?
There is nothing in the policy right now about second. You get a hearty handshake. Great job,
They get what we get. And the award ceremonies in Palm Springs.
Yeah, the CWA has their annual conference in Palm Springs. So one of the luncheons, they'll have the award ceremony. So a few of our employees will be going down to that for the conference, and they'll attend the awards ceremony and receive the awards on behalf of CMSA while they're there.
Would they normally attend the conference?
Yeah, we usually send, probably four or five employees to the CWA annual conference.
All right. Moving right along, we have a report on organic waste receiving, item 6.
Yeah. So just a comment on this agenda. We didn't have a lot of significant items put on the agenda, so I included some more informational items, the next three things, and I did that, one, because we have a couple, this fiscal year, we have a couple new board members and a couple new alternates, so I thought it would be a good time just to present some of these outside the consent calendar, so that way if you had any questions or wanted me to kind of walk through them, I could do that for you guys. So the first one of those is our organic waste receiving program report, and this is a report that one of our staff members, Mary Jo Ramey, an environmental services analyst, prepares on a weekly basis for the program. And it started back in early 2014 after we began receiving the fats, oils, and grease, you know, organic materials and the food waste from Marin Sanitary Service. And this particular program has expanded and evolved over the years, and there's a lot more things that we're tracking now. And it has a lot of great information in it, and we refer to this on a weekly basis, operations staff, you know, technical services staff. And attached to the staff report is the report for the week of March 26th to April 1st. And if you like, I can kind of walk through the report real quick, or if not, I could just answer any questions you might have.
I'm fine with you walking through the report.
Okay, I'll just kind of walk through each table real quick. So on page one, there's two tables. First one is information about how much fats, oils, and grease we receive. So it breaks it down by weekly. A lot of tables are like this. They'll have weekly, what's the amounts in March, year-to-date, and then cumulatives from the first load, which is for the fog, was November 12th, 2013. So you see for this week, there were 19 loads that came in. Each one's about 5,000 gallons for 95,000 gallons that week. Then if you look, we received at the bottom row, last column, we received 10.3 million gallons of fog since we started receiving in 2013. So that's the first table. The second one is very similar, but it's the food waste, and that's, you know, specifically from Marin Sanitary Service. Then that's the number of loads in the first column, then the size of the load. And the size of the load has increased from when the program first started up in January of 14. And I mentioned the staff report. The Marin Sanitary Service, they had a program with about 13 or 14, you know, restaurants in downtown San Rafael, and they're collecting their food waste and bringing it to a in-vessel compost, you know, piece of equipment that was on their site. And they, you know, were testing out composting of the food waste with, you know, green waste, and they were taking that to their compost facility out in Zamora. So once the food energy program started up in January 14, those were the first 13 participants. They shut down the in-vessel composting. They brought that material here. So the number of participants have grown from 13 to 186, and that's shown on another table. So the original, I think the first load size was about 3 tons from those 13. They were bigger restaurants. And now we're up to about 8 tons a day on average coming in.
Can any restaurant be part of this program?
Yeah, they can.
Now, the food waste was sanitation, but the fats and oils and grease, fog, yeah, that's collected by private haulers and brought here. Who's paying the haulers?
The haulers are being paid for by the restaurants or the markets.
Okay, and so they're paying them to get rid of it. They're not, obviously they have to get rid of their grease.
Yeah, it's collected in grease traps and grease interceptors, yep, right, in the kitchens, and they have to keep those clean.
Yep.
So they'll call a hauler to come in and pump those out.
Right, okay.
Depending upon the size of the facility, and of course our agency does the review, mm-hmm, of the on the interceptors and all that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So in regards to any restaurant be eligible, they can, and Marin Sanitary Service determines if they're eligible or not. And if they determine they're eligible, they will try to recruit them into the program.
Okay. They have to agree to, there's a certain spatial demand for this. They have to have, I can't think of what the things are called, but there's a funny term in the restaurant industry for a specific kind of a waste container that's easy to move around in the kitchen and allows the prep, line prep, to easily dispose of the waste while they're working. And if the kitchen doesn't have the design to accommodate that, they may not go on board with it right away. So,
but that would be the food waste, because of course the fogs are collected on the grease trap.
Yeah. No, this is the pre-consumer food,
yep,
waste.
Okay.
It's from the prep line.
Sure.
And so what works really well is when they make the connection when a restaurant is built. Yes.
Yes.
Well, I'll keep that in mind. I do a lot of business with restaurants, so I'll always suggest them that.
Well, that's one of the things that I always, when it's in my jurisdiction, I make sure, you know, like I introduce myself to the restaurant, like, oh, now you're working with Marin Sanitary, you're designing.
Good.
Okay, then the third table shows the amount of reject material from the processing of the food waste and fog slurry. So, you know, the fog, and there's a picture, let me refer you back to into the staff reports. There's a picture on page 2 of the facility. Then you see the red dashed areas. Mm-hmm. So there's one area there above a concrete slab. That's where the fog truck pulls up. Then they attach a hose to their truck and to a receiving, you know, pipe. And they pump that liquid fog through the system. And there's a big, you know, it's a heavy screen on there. So that screen prevents nearly all the debris from getting into the tank. So that works pretty well. Then the food waste, it's that other red dash line, and Marin Sanitary backs their truck up there. We open up the hatches, and they dump the food waste slurry into the tank there. So the pumice, or the reject material, it's not contaminants like you would think. It's not, you know, bones and metal objects and plastic. All of that's removed in the kitchens, you know, through the sorting that the kitchen staff does, or it's removed by Marin Sanitary Service. A little bit makes it in. So that slurry then, it's pumped through another piece of equipment called a paddle finisher, and that's actually a picture also I included on page. Let's see here, page 3. So that fog and food waste slurry is pumped into that paddle finisher. You can imagine that being like this, like a Coke can with all these orifices on the side. It's pressurized. It's just pushing the material, extruding it through those little orifices. So anything that won't make it through the little hole on the surface area comes out the front end and gets discharged in this green bin. So if we were out there and we looked inside that green bin, it's going to be mainly organic materials. It's going to be like little rind pieces from, you know, lemons and melons and oranges and fibrous material from, like, you know, corn cob husks, things like that. So in our contract with the Marin Sanitary Service, each week now it's 2 or 3 times a week, they pick this up and they take and they mix it with the products from their domestic, you know, food waste, green waste program, mix that all together, and they take that for composting, either whatever landfill or at this site that they co-own with some other solid waste haulers up in Zamora, which is off 505. So what you see in this table, it just shows how many bins were picked up, you know, week, month, annual, cumulative, and it shows what's the weight of the material that's picked up versus what was delivered, and you have percentages in that last column. So you can see since we started the program, it's about 6% reject or contamination, but it's all reused as compost. Now, East Bay Mud, when I was at this Denmark trip, their engineering director was there, and we were talking about, you know, their, you know, organic waste program, which is a small piece of that is the food waste. He said they're up to like 40% contamination because they don't have, you know, any outreach into the restaurants, and they don't have any type of a sorting there. It just all comes in and it goes to the paddle finisher.
Well, that's been a problem for them all along.
Yeah, since we started talking to them back when ours was being designed in 2010. So we have a really low contamination. That's what's shown in Table 3. Table 4 is just the number of participants. I mentioned it started out with about 13. Last report, it was 183. Most of those are within Marin's Sanitary Services service area, restaurants or markets of different sizes. And a much smaller number is from Mill Valley Refuse's service area. They've been trained by Marin Sanitary Service, so they've kind of created their own food energy program where they collect food waste from primarily grocery stores, large grocery stores within their service area. Then they bring that material to Marin Sanitary Service under their own arrangement, and then Marin Sanitary Service runs it through their sort line and grinding, you know, process, and they bring that to us. Then Table 5 is new information that we added just a couple months ago. And this shows, I won't spend too much time here, but essentially the second column shows how much material we send to the digester on a weekly or monthly basis. So if you look at the first row, so we'll send 267,000 pounds of material to the digester. So then we want to know, okay, if we're sending that much, how much is the primary sludge, how much is the thickened waste activated sludge, and how much is the organic slurry from the organic waste receiving tank? So we track all that separately, and this shows the pounds for each of those feedstocks and its percentage to the total. So we started tracking that because we had heard that once you get to 30% loading from organics, there could be problems with the digester. We haven't experienced any problems with digesters, so we started tracking on this. So we created the table. So this kind of shows it. So right now we're at 31% volatile solids, and that's the material that can be converted to biogas, the volatile component of the total solids. Then table six.
When you were up at 33, did you see any issues?
No, we haven't had any problems with digester operations or health or quality of the biosolids since we started the program.
Excuse me, Jason. So VS is volatile solids, and what is TS?
Total solids.
Thank you.
So the total includes the volatile and the inorganic.
And you were saying the volatile can... How did you distinguish it from the total? It is...
It's the organic content.
It's the organic content of the material
solids
coming in.
Of the material being pumped in the digester.
So it's more rich.
Yeah, which one do we like?
We like the volatile solid.
Yeah, okay.
For biogas production.
We want to be biogas, so we want to be volatile.
We want to be volatile.
Yeah, for example,
that's what I figured.
Well, so like the organic material, both feedstocks, the fog and the food waste, you know, they're about 91% volatile. So if you have 10 pounds of this stuff, about 9 pounds will be organic, and a good portion of that gets converted into biogas because it's not a perfect, you know, conversion or breakdown by the microbes. Okay, then table 6, these are just standard analyses that we always perform on the digesters. And so you have alkalinity, volatile acids, pH. These are what our lab measures. And these numbers are great, and these are very similar to the values that we had before we started feeding the organic waste of digesters. We'd be concerned if we saw the alkalinity getting pretty low or the volatile acids getting really high, then the different groups of microbes that are doing the work in the digesters would be affected by that. And the detention time, what that is, that's how it's kind of, it's calculated by the amount of, you know, gallons, you know, input to the side of the digester. So that's showing you we have a lot of hydraulic capacity in the digesters, and the minimum number we have under EPA regulations for land application is 15 days. So once we get close to 15 days, we'd be a little concerned. So we have a lot of capacity in the digesters. Then the next table shows digester gas production in the digesters and the number of hours of runtime of the cogeneration system on that biogas. So prior to receiving organic waste, the 5-year daily average was 125,000 cubic feet per day. Of course, you know that changes on a daily basis and seasonal. But if you average that over 5 years, 125,000. So you can see because of the organic waste program, we're up, you know, for the month of March anyway, it's been 316,000 cubic feet. So huge increase there. Then you can see because of that extra biogas, we're not having to buy much natural gas to power the engine. So you can see below the table there was 5 days a couple weeks ago that we ran 24/7 on the biogas, and the other days were 22 hours. So we're pretty close to being energy self-sufficient.
Flag, you know, some kind of an energy flag we can raise on those days, like the mills that say 14 hours since an accident, you know, 140 days since an accident. We could have. We're running on biogas.
Or a big clock, percentage of gas, you know, 97%.
We have to think of something that we could...
And have it so you could see it all.
Oh, yeah.
We know we're tracking it. So what we could do is we could, you know, like annually, we could report it out on our website, you know, in 2017, we ran this many days on biogas.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just have a little spot on the website.
Yeah, it shows that, yeah.
Yeah, maybe
make a note of that. We'll
yeah, people like daily updating sort of things, though. It's like, yeah. You know, the counter for the day, though, you know, how much biogas has been produced and how much electricity has been produced.
Well, and maybe, you know, when one of the classes from one of the high schools comes in, you know, that might be sort of a engineering class or something, conceivably it could be suggested that they might come up with some way of having some, besides the graphic, that maybe there'd be something that we could come up with to show this.
Yeah,
that
it should be on our social media.
Can I have that?
Yeah,
that's
might have to start tweeting.
You're going to start tweeting. At 4 in the morning,
Jason. Oh, okay. Get right on that.
Yeah. We'll look at doing some type of reporting on the website. Okay. We'll talk about it.
We're hashtag at CMSA, right?
Oh, yeah. Okay, so the last page are two kind of newer tables also. One is looking at the expenses for the program and then the revenues. So we track the expenses pretty closely. So you see there's a lot of equipment that's used to operate that organic waste receiving facility. So we're tracking how much energy is used, and we convert that to cost using the value of natural gas that we're not having to use in the engine. Then anytime an electrician or mechanic works on it, they track that on their time sheet. That gets entered into our CMMS system. Anytime operations staff people are receiving loads, operating the facility, doing a cleanup out there, they track that on their time sheets. And then, like Mary Jo, who oversees kind of the administrative part of the program, she tracks all of her time, you know, taking samples, analyzing the samples with the lab staff, preparing the weekly reports. That's on the admin costs. Then miscellaneous costs are captured under other. So you can see so far this year we've spent about $46,000 on the program. Then down below in the revenue table, you can see our revenue sources. One, you know, is the fog tipping fees. One is the food waste tipping fees. And then the biogas,
value.
Equivalent biogas value, and that's tied to the natural gas, you know.
That we don't buy.
So far this year, it's been positive. It's $57,000 revenue versus $46,000. What's nice about this is that, you know, all our other revenue sources, in particular the regional charges fund member agencies, they're not having to pay for any part of this program. It's all kind of self-supporting. Last year, there was a kind of a mix-up in the staff report on page 4. Expenses were $277,000 last year, and revenues were $268,000. So it was almost self-supporting last year. That's pretty good. We're pretty excited about that also.
Yeah, on your program expenses, that a monthly cost of $12,000, that seems incredibly low to run those engines. Is this like the pro rata share from just the biogas operation?
Oh, this is just the cost, the energy cost to run the mixing pumps, the digester feed pumps, the paddle finisher. So it's all the equipment associated with the receiving facility.
Okay.
It doesn't include any of like the digester mixing operation, which is the wastewater side, or the cogeneration operation. Because all that we would have anyways.
Okay. Gotcha.
Because if we weren't running it on biogas, the engine, we'd run it on natural gas. So it still had the same wear and tear as the biogas.
Right. Okay.
Okay, so that's that weekly report. So
it's really fascinating. It's good. And, you know, obviously it's going in the right direction.
Great, thank you.
In many ways. Our next item on the agenda is from our new Administrative Services Manager, and it is our fiscal year 2017 third quarter budget report, which you would like us to accept. Would you like to
talk about it? Sure. So this is normally a consent calendar item, but we put this on the regular business item. So if you guys would like a presentation like I did with the last one, or if you have some questions, the really short presentation is that at the end of the third quarter, which straight line projection is 75%, you know, expenses, revenues. Revenues are at 76%, which is good, and expenses are at 72%. And we track the expenses being actual cash expenses, money we paid, and also encumbered expenses. So if we have purchase orders or contracts or services that we're going to receive, we include that also. So it's kind of like a modified accrual basis. Is that right, Ken?
Yeah.
That's my only auditing term I know.
Modified accrual, there you go.
So that's kind of a high-level summary. Then there's a series of tables in here, and then attached is the third quarter capital program report with the budget figure, the expenditures, encumbrances, and a little status update on all the various activities. So I could give a presentation on this, or I could just answer questions, whatever the board would like.
Do we have any questions?
I do. The contributions to debt service is high, which is good. I mean, that's excellent. Why is it so high at the third quarter?
That's a good question. So we have to pay debt service to the bond trustee.
Yeah.
So that's a certain amount of money. So our debt service invoices to the member agencies and also San Quentin, it includes the bulk, which is what we have to pay to the trustee, plus it also includes a coverage amount. So our bond indenture document, specifically the rate covenant, says that we have to collect 25% coverage on the debt service. So what we do is we invoice the member agencies in July for the first of two debt service payments. So that's for all of the principal and percentage of the interest. That's usually promptly paid, you know, in August, then we pay the trustees in September. Then we have a second payment, which is in March. So we send invoices out, which is just the remaining interest piece. And those were out in January, were paid in February, then we paid the trustee in March. So what you see reflected here are both of the invoices to the member agencies and their payments to us. And the reason it's not 100%,
right,
which you would think
would
be, is because since... Because we invoice San Quentin monthly for wastewater services, and there's three components in that contract. There's operation of the pump station, that has a different basis. There is wastewater treatment, which is allocated based on flow and strength, like all the member agencies. Then we have capital contribution for debt service. So theirs is determined, allocated based on EDUs, just like the members. So that's 1/12 of theirs we collect each month. And of course, we invoice them, you know, probably 2 weeks after the month's over. So we've only received their debt service contributions through end of February, I think. So there's still some debt service contributions we're going to receive from San Quentin through the end of the year, probably into, you know, early August with the last payment from them.
Do we ever exceed the debt service in order to get a handle, lower our?
Do we ever exceed?
Can you pay down more than the debt?
We did.
We refinanced the debt a couple years ago.
You can't pay it down on this one until usually it's sort of a 10-year call protection.
Okay.
But it got refunded.
Yeah, so now there's 17 years of term left on the refinance bonds, and I don't know what the call period is.
Probably 10.
Probably. Yeah, the first one was 10.
Yeah, this one is 10.
30-year issuance, yeah. Fine.
Any other questions from the board?
So our CIP for 10 years is about $8.5 million. Is that it? That's the sum of our CIP?
The CIP, this, I'd have to look in.
Well, it shows, you know, fiscal year 17 through 26.
Yes, well, some of the projects in the CIP, table, which is similar to this,
yeah,
it's going to have projects for all 10 years. This table only shows the projects that are for fiscal year 17, and of those projects, some of those might be multi-year, so there's expenses that we've already, you know, paid for, and some that are going to be in outer years. So this table, that's a handout,
yeah,
doesn't include all the other CIP activities for FY18 through FY25.
But why is it saying that? In other words, for some of these projects are going to go for 10 years. Is that it? So it totals that up?
So let's maybe pick one here that we're... The odor control improvements?
Yeah.
Odor control improvements is in the third section... Mid-page.
Oh, okay.
It's highlighted.
Oh, it's highlighted.
Yeah.
So,
for that one, that's a longer-term project. So it's from fiscal year 15 to 26. I'm looking at the second set of data in the columns there. So in previous years, we spent $113,000. So there were elements there for probably like, you know, some studies, some evaluations, things of that nature. Then in this current CIP in the budget, there's about $4.1 million in the budget. Only 300 and what is it? What's how much do we have this year? Only 370 is allocated for this year. So if you add up the 10-year CIP plus what we spent, it's $4.2 million. So far this year, we've only spent $61,000, but we've encumbered $273,000. So for this project, this is now this one of the outcomes of prior year evaluation was to make the enhancements to the ventilation system in the solids handling building. And that construction contract was awarded last month, so we've encumbered those funds. So that's why it's encumbered here.
Okay, but Jason, what's that $4.1 million? That's how much is going to be spent through 20.
In a few years from now, we have money that are just placeholders for replacing some of the wet chemical scrubbers around the agency. So that was a recommendation one of the studies that you should consider replacing those in the future. So we have money in the CIP in future years to do that. So
that's part of odor control.
Yeah. And we may or may not do that because they're working pretty well.
Well, why did you include some in that column, CIP 10-year, and not others?
Because in this section, these are only the multi-year projects that have FY17 activity.
Okay. So
like when we look at FY18 next year, there may be other projects that are for FY18 that are multi-year, then we'll show those on this table. And just talking with Ken today, we're gonna reorganize this so it's a little easier to read. It flows a little better.
I was going to comment too that those out-year projects are not funded. The only projects that are funded is in the FY17-18 fiscal year. Yeah.
Well, I was just trying to understand this, so it's a little bit down.
Yeah, we'll when the finance committee gets together, we'll take a look at the actual 10-year CIP.
Right?
Pardon me?
It's real soon, right?
Yeah, the 27th, Thursday the 27th.
Okay.
So this is kind of, in other words, this is the FY17 plus an excerpt of the 10-year CIP. Okay. When you have multi-year project.
Do we bond fund these, or do we pay directly off the rates?
These are paid a few different sources on this. One is that coverage, money that we're receiving for the debt service. That goes into a restricted reserve fund, and that is used to pay for future CIP. If we receive any connection fees or capacity charges, if there's new development or hookups in the sewer system, that's used to fund, the CIP. And then anything in an unrestricted reserve account for capital is used to pay. And those are from dedicated, regional charge revenues for capital. So like Santa Fe Sand, this year, $630,000 of our fee to them is for capital. So that will go into this unrestricted reserve account. And we use for capital. If we have any excess operating funds this year, like say normally on the operating expense side is maybe anywhere from 92 to 96% of the budget, that savings, we call it savings, additional monies flows into the unrestricted capital reserve account. So that's a funding source too. But there's a hierarchy too. At first we use capacity charges. So say we got $1 million in capacity charges, that'll be used first. Then we use the restricted coverage, bunnies. Then we'll use unrestricted capital funds. That's kind of how we do that. That makes sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
That's good, because the only restricted money you get, aside from board restricted, is your capacity charges. They have to be used for capital. So
yeah.
Spend it first.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right.
First in, first out.
Yes.
I just had a question. It may not be a project, but just regarding sort of emergency preparedness and stuff, do you have a budget for stocking extra pipe, large parts, things like that, should there be a major seismic event or any other natural disaster? Is there like a program you have for that?
We've our staff have went out and they've identified all the critical processes and equipment at the agency. So we carry spare pieces of equipment or major components for that critical equipment in inventory. So if something were to happen, a piece of equipment fails, then we have something, in stock that we could, use for that that situation. we don't have a lot of money set aside for if there's something like a major disaster, you know, like a major earthquake and there's significant structural problems, you know, with tanks or things like that. We don't have you know, funds to address that. We would go to our insurance carrier.
Sure. I was thinking more like, you know, like the equipment side, like large diameter pieces of gravity sewer pipe that we need.
Yeah, since we don't, you know, we don't maintain the sewer system, so we don't have like the manholes or the sewer pipe or sections of force main, or we do carry like some air relief valves and some things like that for the agencies that we provide contract services to, but we don't have like a yard with, you know, piping in it.
That's a good question. What about if there were supply chain disruptions for critical chemicals? What sort of I don't know the
inventory.
Term. Huh? What kind of inventory do we have for?
Well, we have pretty good inventory, chemical inventory, for most of the year. But when we have people weather events, we go through the inventory pretty fast. But normally, what our staff will do is they will they're tracking on the weather. And they'll see when a major storm's coming in, so they'll pre-order a lot of the chemicals. For example, like sodium hypochlorite, you know, like the disinfecting chemical. We have 5,000-6,000 gallon tanks, so we'll fill those tanks up before the major storm event. And we just have a new practice that we implemented this last wet weather season. Is we have these 20,000 gallon underground storage vaults. So if there's a leak of something in the room, they drain into the vault. We decided, well, geez, why don't we fill those vaults up with the chemical too? So if there's a supply chain disruption, which there was this last winter with our sodium bisulfite supplier, they sent, you know, all of their contract agencies a letter saying that they're having, you know, supply, feedstock supply issues, and they may not be able to deliver. So we got a little nervous because of that, and some of our deliveries didn't come in. Sometimes they were half deliveries, and these were big storm events were coming in. So we decided also to have a secondary chemical supply contract where with another supplier, that we didn't select through the low bid process, but just in case if there are slight supply disruptions with that low bidder.
Okay.
Not a big deal, Jason. It was kind of chump change, but the other non-operating revenue you had pegged at 20K, and you've got three. Again, it's not a big ticket item. I'm just curious why it's so low. Are you anticipating any funds there, or is it going to remain a little off?
Yeah, I don't have a good answer, you know, to that question of what is included in that budget figure. I think it's a kind of a placeholder on the revenue side, and it was developed just using an evaluation of prior years non-operating revenues. But I could follow up with our finance staff. Ken, do you happen to know that?
I don't. I need to see what's actually she's classifying as going into that account. And that there are many things that, you know, they get collected kind of equally throughout the year, and then they get collected at the beginning of the year, at the end of the year, and so it's hard to know without seeing the details of what flows into that account.
Well, it's kind of chump change, but
yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So on page three, yeah, there's a little paragraph,
yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
That talks about some of the monies we received, yeah. And what catches my eye here is the last paragraph where it says pooled liability dividends. So from a CSR Medical insurance carrier, on the pool liability side, also on the workers' comp side, if expenses are a lot less than they projected through their actuarial evaluations, then the membership receives some of those monies back. And there's formulas, you know, for dividends they receive back, and also for a retroactive adjustment program. So those would be considered, you know, other revenues that would go into this account.
And since you got a first place safety award, you should do okay on that one.
Yeah, unfortunately, it's a pool. How well the pool does, not just CMSA. Yeah. Well, if there's money savings in the pool, then you look at how well CMSA did versus compared to prior years. So we can receive a bigger portion of what the pool gets.
Okay. Shall we move on to item 8 on our agenda?
So this is just status update on what's happening on the recycled water side. So if you call between 2013 and 2015.
Sorry, don't we have to accept that third party clerk?
Oh, excuse me. You are quite right. We do need to accept
it. I move to accept the third quarter budget report for fiscal 2016-2017.
Second. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Carries. Sorry. This one is to just... We will provide direction as appropriate.
Yeah, this one. Okay. So this item is something that the agency worked on and the board talked a lot about from 2013 through early 2016. And since we had some new board members and alternates, I figured it would be a good time to give a good update on the three key areas. That was the recycled water feasibility study, the recycled water truck filling program, and then the legal authority that CMSA has is being the owner of the recycled water, and we can and can't do under state law. So just to be real brief here on the recycled water feasibility study, there was, you know, a few things that we learned from that. One was that there are potentially a lot of recycled water users within the CMSA service area, but they're all very small users, and they're far away. So it would cost a lot of money to build the infrastructure to deliver recycled water to most of the users, to where, from the water district perspective, it would be cost prohibitive. We also learned that the recommended project, which was a little more feasible, was to construct a tertiary treatment facility here at CMSA and deliver tertiary treated recycled water over to San Quentin State Prison, where it would be used for a few uses, one being inmate cell toilet flushing, using the potable water for that now. And the cost of that was about a little under $3,000 per acre foot, compared to MMWD's cost for water right now. Their cost to produce water from the San Juan treatment plant is about $680 an acre foot, or was it a couple years ago. And the cost to buy recycled water from the Sonoma, to buy potable water from the Sonoma County Water Agency was about $1,000 an acre foot. So this is, you know, triple that. So really the outcome of this was that the water district included the recommended project as one of the alternatives in their 2040 water supply master plan. That's where that's kind of been left by the water district. Then on the truck fill program, so we worked with the water district, and this was a good collaborative exercise with us. Hired a consultant, Kennedy Jenks. They prepared what's called a Title 22 engineering report for the truck fill program. We spent, you know, several months, you know, going through a process of figuring out where's the best place to get the recycled water sample, how do we do that, and then get 3 months of data to show that our recycled water meets a certain quality, and that's called secondary 23. So we did that. They accepted, you know, the report, and they said, you guys can go ahead, MMWD and CMSA, your proposal is accepted, and you can deliver, you know, recycled water through the truck fill program for acceptable uses under Title 22. And I did include that section from the state code in an attachment to the staff report, and that's attachment number 3. So that was all accepted, and in 2015 we built it. It was ready in early 2016, but that was during the wet weather. And through the summertime, the member agencies didn't receive the authorization with training and then authorization and permitting from MMWD to receive the recycled water from the truck fill station. I think Santa Fe Sand did toward the end of the summer, but then it started raining a little earlier, so they didn't pick up any. And the other two districts, I think, are contacting the water district, you know, now to get the training. And I think that we just have a training scheduled for at CMSA for Ross Alexandria District. Chris, you know the date on that?
April 21st, next Friday. There'll be two sessions for Ross Valley coming in.
So their staff will come here and they'll be trained by the water district on what are uses, acceptable uses, unauthorized uses, what type of, you know, trucks they have to have, markings and signage for the trucks. They'll go out with our staff and we'll show them how to use the truck fill station, what paperwork to fill out, things like that. But as of today, we haven't delivered any recycled water from the truck fill program. And here's a picture of the little station here. You see all the different attachments that we've constructed there for different types of hoses to connect up.
When you say you haven't delivered it, you haven't had any trucks pulling in and actually using it.
That's right.
And if you don't mind my asking one other question, are there any private users who are coming in, or who have expressed interest in getting the proper training so that they can utilize it? And I'm thinking like Roy's Sewer Service,
or
which ST2 uses.
For
Yes. So the program was was going to start out with the member agencies picking it up for sewer line flushing.
Yep.
And then it was going to be possibly expanded to other potential users within the CMSA service area. So when we talked with MMWD about that, because they have all the information on water use, and especially for irrigation and contractors that use it for dust control and other private companies like Roy Sewer that use it for sewer line flushing, they have all that information and they could reach out. And we said that we'd work with them on that. And there was a delay in that because their public information officer, you know, retired or separated, one or the other. And when I talked with Krishna back in the fall, he said, well, let's wait till the new PIO is hired and gets acclimated at the agency. And that happened. I just sent a note out a couple of weeks ago to Paul Cellier, their water quality division manager, who most of you met when he came to some of the presentations, and he said he was going to check on that. So that's in the works on the water district side. But they would identify the users. They would have to train them, get them permitted, and they could come here, show us their permit, and we would fill their trucks up.
One is, we had a big discussion about they're not going to charge the member agencies for the water.
That's right.
Okay, that's one. And two, why do we need Title 22 water for flushing sewers? Can't we get by with something a lot? Does it require extra treatment to get to Title 22 water for us?
Well, you know, you can take a look at the table back here, and sewer line flushing is the last.
Well, I didn't find it. That was going to be the last.
The last column on page 2. So you could use undisinfected secondary water. So essentially what that means is that you could pull water out of the CMSA's chlorine contact tanks and use it.
Yeah.
That could be done. Okay, but we have the truck fill station.
Do we have to do extra treatment for Title 22 water?
Yeah.
But Title 22 has these. All of these are Title 22, and they just have different categories. So you start with undisinfected secondary, then disinfected 23, then 2.2, then tertiary. So Title 22.
What I'm asking is our standard 20 effluent meet Title 22?
Our normal effluent?
Yeah.
Meets most of the time it meets secondary 23 requirements. For the truck fill program, though, we provide a little additional disinfection to ensure that it meets the Title 23 requirements. So, like all the water that we use here for irrigation or reuse meets the secondary 23 requirements.
See, our trucks can, like in the morning, load up.
But they haven't been at all.
Which I think is the biggest problem. I'm glad to hear that they're on. They're booked in for on the training, but we're supposed to provide direction to staff as appropriate. I would like to direct staff to take any and all measures.
Light a fire?
Yeah.
Yeah, get this going.
Let's get this going. We've spent years building this thing, and it's not a work of art to look at.
Yeah. Well, you know,
we remember the one we had before it.
I would direct board members to notify their member agencies as well. Get on this, because I know our board wants to do it.
Get going. Ours is good.
Yeah.
We're ready to go.
Yeah. You guys were ahead of us.
We're ahead of everyone.
So from the CMSA perspective, we have, you know, the sampling and procedures.
We'll get there tomorrow morning. We'll be
good. Yeah,
you don't have to even have your training for 2 weeks.
Yeah. You guys can load up.
Well, we could, but we haven't needed to flush. And with all the rain, that's about the last thing we need to worry about.
So there's a couple factors that, you know, get involved with this. One is, especially for the member agencies, and I'm assuming this is for the member agencies, but I know, and this is based on my discussions with staff at Novato Sanitary. So they have a much larger, you know, expanded recycled water program, and they produce tertiary treated water. And is in partnership with the North Marin Water District, and they have pipelines going in, bringing water to elementary schools and parks and various areas. And they have some purple fire hydrants close to the sanitary district and by the water district. So I asked the manager of the sanitary district one time, well, do your staff go back and fill up with recycled water? He said, well, we'll go and fill up in the morning, but it's just not cost effective for us to go out during the day and drive all the way back to the purple hydrants, because it's more cost effective just to buy the potable water for use than spend the half an hour driving back to where the purple hydrant was, fill up for free, and then drive back. So the labor and cost and fuel is more expensive. So the member agencies may have been thinking about that also. I'm just not quite sure about that.
Well, that's what I was saying. In the morning, you know, we come in and load your trucks up, and probably you don't come back.
And we don't have the drought situation anymore, which was a big driver for us in 2014 and 2015. It was what motivated the water district to work with us collaboratively.
Yeah, but rates are going up, so it would be beneficial to each of our districts if we could direct.
That's the water. It's here. We have the procedures in place. It's here, and we'll fill up whatever trucks show up. So as soon as the members come in, we'll deliver the water, and we'll keep, you know, contacting the water district about, you know, the outreach and identification of other potential users. So we can do that.
Right. Let's not wait until we're in the drought and everybody wants to get certified. Mm-hmm. It takes months to get certified. Let's be ready.
And get in the habit of using.
Yeah.
So you said you have a training currently scheduled. Was that with Ross Valley?
Yeah. So Ross Valley's coordinated the training with the water district, but they're holding it here because we need to bring them down to the
truck. Can you accommodate more?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
And when is that training?
21st.
21st.
We have one scheduled at 8 a.m. and we have one training scheduled at 9:30 a.m.
Okay, is there a limit to the number of people?
No. What Ross Valley did is they wanted to make sure that they had a crew out in their collection system at all times, so that there's like a half hour in between so they can get one crew here and then one crew back on station.
But it's an hour of training and that's all that's required?
Hour of training, classroom and training out at the facility.
Yeah, and this is required by the water district, so we're not familiar with what all the different type elements of the training are,
right,
or if there's things that have to be done beforehand or afterhand. But what we know is that they've coordinated, we're providing the space for the training, and we'll make sure we have staff, you know, available to escort them out to the fill station.
All right. Well, let's hope that we get some action here.
So
visits to the fill station. This was
just
information, with no action needed.
So
I'll let you know. If you need to do it, I'll let you know.
So I'll reach out to the member agencies again tomorrow and say, hey, the CMSA board was really interested in using the recycled water, and I'll send a follow-up note to the water district and just see what the status of their reaching out to potential users in the service area.
Now I know why we're having those cookies tonight. I got it. I just got it. You know, I suggested Carlsberg. Next item on the agenda is item number 9, Denmark Wastewater Fact-Finding Trip Presentation.
Okay, so we'll kind of move through this pretty quick here. So,
go get a cookie.
Danish cookie.
So one of my...
Bring the tin over.
I'll just sit with it over here.
One of my colleagues who retired from East Bay Mud, actually, Ed McCormick, he was the president of WEF, and he knew some of the people that were involved with the Water Technology Alliance when they were stationed out in Illinois. And they were looking at setting up, you know, an operation here in California, in the peninsula. And they're having this presentation with the SFPUC, so they reached out to Ed and said, Ed, is there some managers we should invite in the Bay Area? So Ed said, well, you should invite Jason. So I got an email from Pia from the WTA, said Ed McCormick suggested we contact you. Would you like to come to this event at the PUC and hear about, you know, wastewater and water in Denmark? So I did that, then eventually Pia and Fleming came to CMSA and met with Chris and I, and we gave them a presentation. They gave us a presentation, gave them a tour about things we're doing here. And then several months later, end of January, they invited me and someone else from CMSA to go on this wastewater fact-finding trip to Denmark. So I invited Chris, and I had to twist his arm for him to come.
And they paid for almost all this?
Yeah, they covered essentially all the costs except for the flight and any per diem that we brought, you know, for miscellaneous expenses while we're there.
I think if you see that in the future, you should always ask the alternate delegates to come.
I will mental note on that.
Mental note.
That's good. That's good. So yes, yeah, so there was in distillate. Our plane ticket was only $410 to Denmark and back. So it was amazing.
What?
$410.
Wow. And most of the help was taxes and fees from the airport.
Wow. Yeah. So it was a great trip. There were 16 members, part of the group. You know, most of them from California agencies, a couple from agencies in Illinois or Indiana, and it was just. Learned a lot. It was fast-paced. I mean, they had, you saw the curriculum or the schedule was attached, and it showed we were up at 7:30 a.m. meeting, you know, in the lobby, and we weren't getting back to the hotel from the day's events and site visits and tours until, you know, 5:45. Then it was, you know, going out to a coordinated dinner that they had and walking distance from the hotel. But we stayed in this town called Aarhus, which is the second largest town in Denmark. And that's a picture of the church in town. We had over those 5 days, we had 1 hour to sightsee. So it was like we got back at 4 o'clock, and they said, "Okay, you guys have 1 hour. Then you have to come back. We're meeting at 5:30 for dinner." So Chris and I went out with a couple other fellows, and we went to go walk around little cobblestone streets, a river running through town, just beautiful. But it was like 32 degrees out, and there was a freezing wind blowing. So we only walked around for. We got to the church and took a picture, and went back to the hotel. So let me see here. So just tell you a little some information about Denmark. Then their country's state of green, which we were really impressed by. Then Chris will tell you a little about the two wastewater facilities that we toured. One was in Aarhus, which is the second. Copenhagen is our first largest city. Aarhus is the second largest city, and the treatment plant was Marcellusborg. And then we took a trip to Odense, which is the third largest city, and toured their Edgeley Mole treatment plant. Then kind of tell you some of the things we learned and what we're going to do at CMSA based on what we learned and some of the other things we did over there. So Denmark, you know where it is right here. So you have these two little island areas in the main part of the country. Only 5.6 million people. Copenhagen was here. Aarhus is right here. And Odense was right here. Their state of green. Now this little... These are some excerpts from some of the slides, presentations that we saw while we were there. And this was from one of the people from the Danish, you know, ministry of, I forget what the ministry she was from, but it handles all the environmental issues. Not the EPA, though, they work for that ministry. But they said they created the state of green after the oil crisis in the early 1970s, because at that time, Denmark was 100% dependent on foreign oil. And after the crisis, they decided that they needed to do a few things. They needed to increase their energy, you know, independence. They needed to save water. They needed to reduce emissions, do a lot of various things. So they created the state of green, which has evolved, you know, over time. And this is kind of just an example of some of the things that they did. It's shown in this chart here. So you see that the economy's, you know, grown over the years. At the same time, energy consumption as a country has been the same. It's been reduced recently. Water consumption has reduced. And their CO2 emissions, and all this is driven by all these various programs in their state of green. So this is some of the things more on the water and wastewater side that we learned about in the state of green. So on the water side, they're focused on, of course, reducing water, and all 100% of the water is from wells because Denmark's flat. Because I mountain bike, so I asked them, "Hey, is mountain bike around here?" And they said, "Oh, we mountain bike a little bit, but it's not that popular because our highest mountain is about 600 feet in the whole country." And we were riding over this little rise and all. And right now we're at the second highest point in the country. This is 400 feet. And we're all, "Oh, okay." But they said one of the things that the government got involved was setting these regulations and making changes. There were all these private water wells and small little companies that provided water from groundwater sources. And then the government required these to be consolidated into municipal utilities. So now cities run the water operation from this consolidation. So it's gotten more efficient. And then they charge a lot for the water. So their price, you know, reflects the true cost of water. So we did some conversions. I think theirs was €8 for every cubic meter. So that converted to $1 for 29 gallons. I think Chris just calculated before the board meeting that CMSA's cost for water is 15 cents for 29 gallons. So there's quite a bit more over there. And there's a lot of taxes, government taxes, on the utilities, on the water and wastewater side. Then for wastewater, they focused on okay, what resources that can we use from the wastewater? They focused on that and also, you know, energy neutrality. And what they did is the government then started, you know, it didn't require it, but they are just motivating organizations and using incentives to consolidate water and wastewater agencies together. And that's happened. So Aarhus and the Odense facility, they're bigger organizations. They have multiple water treatment plants and wastewater treatment plants and all the distribution under each entity. And then they also, on the wastewater side, they focused on, you know, energy production, removing, you know, phosphorus from the biosolids, because phosphorus is a renewable resource and there's a kind of a worldwide shortage on phosphorus, so there are, you know, ways to extract it out of other areas. And they recycle a lot of the heat from the wastewater process, and I'll talk about that in a minute too. So on the wastewater facilities, and Chris will talk about this, but this is some of the consolidation. So this is the greater Aarhus area right here. And these were all the wastewater plants that they had prior to 2008. So in this multi-phase consolidation, they've shut down all these wastewater plants with an X and converted to pump stations, and they're pumping the wastewater to these four main plants. And this is the Marcellusburg plant that we toured. Then over the next 14 years, they're going to be shutting down two of the bigger plants and expanding the two other plants. So that's kind of what they're doing in terms of consolidation.
How does the discharge compare to what we're required to do?
It's different. We don't know all the differences, but a couple key things we learned is that they're not required to disinfect their wastewater like we are. So pretty much all the facilities in the U.S. now under the Clean Water Act, there's a couple of exemptions for ocean dischargers, but they all have to disinfect. And then non-ocean dischargers, they have to dechlorinate. So we disinfect and dechlorinate. Mm-hmm. Most of these facilities don't have to disinfect at all. So it's undisinfected, you know, tertiary treated, essentially, nutrient-removed water that goes out. There's a couple areas where they've designated the waters as swimming areas where they disinfect, but most don't require disinfection. But what at least the two facilities we toured and a lot of the others, they have to remove nutrients in the wastewater, such as phosphorus and nitrogen. We don't have to remove that, but a lot of agencies now are having to do that in the United States. So I'll give this to Chris. This is the Marcellusburg plant that we toured. Chris?
All right. So you can kind of get an idea of the facilities here at Marcellusburg. This plant is operated by Aarhus Vand, the water district, they run the treatment plant there. If I did my conversions right, from metric to our standard conversion, this is about a 22 million gallon per day facility. You can see it's very similar to ours. Their primaries are covered. They have a secondary treatment, centrifuge here, their combined heat and power cogeneration system. And then right here is one of their motor control centers, and they rely heavily on automated equipment. Some of the key takeaways from this facility for me are they invested heavily in their new technology. They tailored their equipment to reduce costs, and they utilize advanced SCADA systems for the control of the facility.
So you see their primary clarifiers are covered. That's because there's a lot of, you know, a lot of apartments and residences around the treatment plant, so they covered all the primaries to contain the odors.
Right.
They've also covered, which you don't see in the diagram, the secondaries. The secondary troughs are covered also to contain odors.
And then here's another picture of the Odense facility. Right here, where's my pointer? Right, moving on. Here's the wastewater treatment plant, kind of an overview of the LHB Mole facility. And then again here, this is the largest treatment plant in Odense, similar treatment processes to CMSA. Kind of see right here where they have their secondary treatment. This is their outfall, their effluent, goes over the outfall weir. This is verification that Jason's actually there with me. And then that's their outfall structure right there, and it discharges right into this river that runs right through the middle of the facility. And then this is their treatment plant manager, very proud of their water. And then here's a picture of effluent monitoring. So these are the different constituents that they're monitoring before.
And that water is crystal clear, that effluent there is.
It's beautiful. It's incredible. And just going back a little bit, this is an original drinking water pump house that's on the Mole site facility. It was converted to an admin building for Van Center Sid, who runs this facility, and then most recently it's more of a historical building now for folks to walk through. Again, this is us taking our tour. There's their anaerobic digesters. It's a little bit hard to see right here, but this is a public walking path right through the middle of the facility. That was a little different for us. We were all, whoa, yeah. People just kind of walk through, okay. And down here, this is their septage receiving station. We have one on site as well. And what I wanted to include here is this building right here was basically the original septage receiving facility before modern treatment works. Night soil, what they called it at that time. So that's where they delivered it all to.
At night, so nobody saw what was going on?
Exactly. Exactly.
And wagon with, drawn by horses.
Exactly. Exactly. And then all.
What do they do with that building now?
That building?
Old reception.
I didn't. Yeah, they weren't using it when we were there.
Thanks, Chris. Mm-hmm. So these are the things that we learned. We kind of summarized here. What was amazing is that their utilities are 150 to 200% energy efficient. We were amazed. Like, how does that happen? Because we're receiving all these organic waste, and we're at like maybe 96% efficient, and they're that high. And there's a few reasons for that. One is, I'll talk about this in these other points here, is that they're really focused on energy efficiency. So in their specifications for equipment, they specify the most energy efficient motors and systems. Like Chris mentioned, they automate all of their treatment processes to minimize the amount of energy for the treatment. And they do that with a lot of instrumentation, having staff that are always calibrating all these instruments so they can automate it and save that the energy. They also standardize in how they calculate the energy that they don't need to heat the water for process use. So like at CMSA, we have our cogen engine, and the exhaust is really hot, and the oil gets hot, and the coolant gets hot, and we run all that through heat exchangers with recycled water, and we heat up the water, and then we use that to heat the digesters, and we also use it to heat a puddle water heating loop, so if you go take a shower, you get some warm water. So we use it for process needs internally, but we have a lot of just waste hot water that we have from another heat exchanger that gets recycled to the head of the plant. What they do is they use it all for internal process, but then also they have district heating. So the cities run piping to the treatment plant, and all that what we would consider waste hot water, they run it through a heat exchanger, and they heat potable water that gets pumped back into the cities. Mm-hmm. So they fully reuse all the heat from their combined heat and power system. And they've calculated the energy savings
and
there.
And that heats multifamily residential buildings and governmental
right.
buildings and
yeah.
schools.
Yeah.
Not their hot water for showers, but their hot water for all the radiators and that kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, how dense is the neighborhood where the treatment plant is?
It was. I don't know how dense, but I mean, driving to it, there were a lot of multi-story apartment buildings and condos and things like that. And then it was right by the Old Town area too. So there were, you know, businesses. So they had places to send that hot water for the radiators and other types of uses. So they calculate the energy savings there, and that's a big contributor to that greater than 100% number there.
Yep. Yeah.
So that's one thing we're gonna figure out is how do we calculate that energy savings for the hot water that we reuse for process needs here, then we can add it to our 96% mm-hmm. and get above 100. So we thought that was interesting. Also, the utilities used to be fully owned and operated by the municipality. That's what they call their cities. Then they explained that they went to a a private ownership. They said where the municipality owns part, then like the public owns part separately from the city, then the city council equivalent appoints some, then the public appoints some to their boards. So it's kind of hard to understand that, but it's called a quasi-private. I thought it was kind of like maybe a special district type of arrangement, not associated with a city or county government. So they mentioned that a few times. And what I also thought was interesting is that they don't receive any organic, you know, waste materials for co-digestion. It all goes to separate private companies where they process into biogas and use that biogas as fuel sources and for different types of energy production facilities. So while we focus on energy production, they're focusing on energy, you know, efficiency and savings. Mm. Then also, they're not regulated by the government EPA. They're regulated by the city that they're in. So the EPA sets these particular standards, and the city takes those and creates the effluent limits, and they produce the permits for the utility. And also, as all the utilities, they have their own lab staff and environmental labs, but they only do lab testing for process control, not for permit compliance. Outside laboratories do that analysis, and they send the results to the EPA, to the municipality, and to the agency. So these are things that we learned. So one of the key takeaways from us that you'll see in our fiscal year 18 business plan that we'll present in June and July is we're going to be looking at monitoring a lot more of our energy consumption by a lot more of our processes and equipment. And once we, do the identification of what we want to monitor, we'll install the monitoring equipment, we'll start tracking that, and then we'll start looking at ways to improve the energy efficiency of the equipment as we, based on that, the baseline data that we produce. They do a lot of that. They monitor what they say when they're here for a follow-up visit, Chris. They hundreds of pieces of equipment they monitor the energy consumption on. Most utilities in the United States, we're not monitoring energy at the equipment level. So this just shows their water price. So you can see here you have one water bill, right? So there's the water piece, now there's this new groundwater protection piece, there's a wastewater piece, and here's the taxes on the water bill to the municipality. And the taxes are for what's in the effluent. So for our hose, and a lot of them, it's going to be nitrogen, phosphorus, and BOD. The more you produce of that or not remove, the more you pay in taxes.
Who pays in taxes?
The utility.
Which is quasi-public to start with, but that's sort of like a carbon tax. It's like
similar to that, yeah. So this is, you see.
Who do they pay it to, Denmark or the state or the...
I think, I don't know who they actually pay it to. I guess it would be to the municipality, maybe the...
Well, it's probably to whoever sets the standard. So it's a higher, whatever the agency is, level that's like the EPA.
I've heard of nitrogen denitrification, but I haven't... What do you do for phosphate removal?
That, that needs to be settled out.
Wait, isn't it phosphorus?
Yeah, phosphorus. You add some type of a precipitant or flocculant or other chemicals that cause that to settle out with your primary sludges, sometimes your secondary sludges. Then that goes to your digesters, and then you remove it through a side stream treatment of your...
Do we discharge with phosphate?
Phosphorus. CMSA does, yes.
Do we?
We do, yeah. Every wastewater agency discharges phosphorus.
Is there any talk about limiting that?
The Regional Water Board's watershed permit, talks about doing studies at, the regional level and at the agency level about different types of ways you can optimize your facilities, construct new facilities, or install side stream treatment to remove nitrogen and phosphorus. A couple of years ago, I gave a presentation on that nutrient watershed permit. We kind of talked about it a little bit. And we just received the CMSA report from HDR Engineering that was working for BACWA to produce these reports for the Regional Water Board to comply with the requirements in the watershed permit.
What do you think about no disinfection? What's your take on that? Is that dangerous?
When you look at Denmark, probably a lot of those treatment plants, they discharge the ocean, and the ocean's probably really cold, and there's not much human contact. So it's not. I don't think it's... They've determined it's not a beneficial reuse of the water body like we have in the United States. We'll say San Francisco Bay, one of the beneficial uses is swimming and recreation. And because of that, you, of course, have to disinfect the water, and you have to dechlorinate it. So I think they probably went through the same assessment there. And I'm saying that because they have identified a couple areas in the country where there's a lot of swimming. And in those areas, they have to disinfect. But they didn't have to dechlorinate, they said.
Didn't you say that it was almost treated to a tertiary level, though, too?
Yeah, to a tertiary... when you're looking at removing all the nutrients and the phosphorus, you go through, sand filters and other types of filtration, which brings it to a tertiary level, and then you remove the nutrients. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the nutrient removal is actually a little beyond tertiary. Mm-hmm. This is a diagram that shows, heat and power system, which is engine-based. They heat the digesters, you know, then it goes into district heating. Then, and what's different here, too, also, is that their power production facility, it sends the power directly to the grid, independent of the agency that sends the power to the grid. Then separately, the agency buys power from the grid what they need. It's not like ours, where it's all kind of interconnected, that we produce what we produce, and then we buy what we need, or pretty soon we'll sell what we don't need. Theirs is kind of like one-way independent from each other. Then we did, you know, we did some other stuff. We toured some factories. So one of the factories I toured was a company called Danfoss, a global company, and they produce a lot of things. This factory was, they produced variable frequency drives. Those are pieces of equipment that control motors on pumps and other pieces of equipment, so you can slow motors down. So we saw it from a little circuit board to a big drive in packaging with a manual package up for shipment, all steps in the process. It was fascinating. I mean, Chris went on a separate tour with a small group where you guys visited, Chris.
Like a pump company called Grundfos and another one, Landier. And we looked at one of their major facilities that was producing pumps for all over the world.
Yeah. Then we did have a 21-hour layover in Amsterdam. Oh. And that's how we got that $400 price. So Chris and I got train tickets, and we spent about 6 hours touring downtown Amsterdam, all around the canals and stuff. And that was
it's all about water.
Yeah. So that was a great time.
Yeah.
On the way home.
Yeah.
And that was our trip. It was a great opportunity, and we learned quite a bit.
Yeah, but I read what you got out of it, and you said something about food and drink. What was the drink?
Oh, you mean my profile?
Yeah.
The last thing I was looking forward to?
Beer!
I was seeing what different types of beers they had there.
Are you kidding?
And I spent just a little bit of time on that.
No.
Two more.
I was 16 when I went to Denmark the first time, and one of my favorite tours was the brewery, and I didn't drink any of it. It just was so exciting to see. And the employer at 16, the employees at that time were given an unlimited supply of beer during the day. Nice. I don't think it's great with that one.
All right.
Well,
the names are good.
That really was fascinating. That chocolate went straight to my vocal cords. What do you have any idea how many other? I know that the North Marin sent people on a parallel trip over.
Yeah, they.
MMWD too.
I don't think anybody from MMWD went, but they had a water fact finding tour. That one with the same group back in December, and the operations manager from Northern Water District attended that. So I talked to him before I went, and just asked him about, you know, what they were doing. He said you're gonna be busy. That's all he said, and we were.
Jason, I'm a little confused. They had that director of that operations holding a glass of water.
Yeah,
it's not disinfected.
That's not. That is their final effluents. So that water was not disinfected, and that's the water that gets discharged right to that little river you saw.
Clean water.
He's not drinking that water.
No, he didn't drink it. He was just showing us how clear it was.
Yeah.
Aren't they overdrafting? If it's all, are they? Did you ever hear about that? It's a problem of overdrafting.
They receive a lot of rain during the year, and they don't have any problems with water supply from their groundwater aquifers. He said what they do have, we didn't talk about this, you know, during the wastewater, you know, fact-finding event, but we did talk about this when they came here and gave a presentation. And they said that there's a lot, because they have a lot of, you know, pig farms and cattle farms out there, and there's a lot of, you know, contamination from the farm, nitrate contamination from the farms and stuff that have contaminated some of the aquifers. So now they have a lot of groundwater monitoring. That was that little charge that you saw on that bill. So they implemented that. So now they're monitoring. They put monitoring wells in, and now they're looking at handling, you know, all the waste from these big animal, you know, ranches and feedlots and stuff differently. But we didn't talk too much about that.
So we're not going to have North Bay Watershed Report because Michael's not here, right? So the next item is oral reports by commissioners and the general manager. Jason, do you want to tell us what you've got to share?
Just a couple quick things. One is that last month we gave a presentation on the PG&E interconnection modification review project and all the pieces of that. And one was an update on the status of the Clean Water State Revolving Fund loan and how it had been, you know, approved at a certain level and it was going through the other levels. And we weren't quite sure if we would be reimbursed for costs before the actual application was finally approved. So we talked about that, and you asked us to contact other agencies that received those type of loans and see if they're reimbursed. Well, we didn't do that because we learned from the staff at the state board is that after the application was deemed complete, which is November, between that time and when it's approved, all those costs will be reimbursed. So we're really happy to learn that. And we have it in an email, too. So we'll add those to our first, you know, reimbursement invoice. Then the next is the GPA Review Committee. So you saw I sent an email out a couple weeks ago about that. So we have three members from SE2, Director first, then Director Bushy from San Rafael San, Dan Hilmer from the Lawrenceburg Council. I went to their council meeting last week and gave a presentation on the GPA review, you know, activities. And then my understanding from talking with Greg Norby at Ross Valley that at their next meeting they'll be appointing a board member to that committee. Then once the committee is formed, I'll reach out and we'll schedule a kickoff meeting. And the last thing is LAFCO has completed the draft Central Marin wastewater SMR report that was distributed out to the agencies, so CMSA, Ross Valley, SD2, San Rafael, Las Colinas, and the county for their two, you know, sewer assessment districts last Friday. So we're going to take a look at that, and we'll have that before the board as a draft document at the May meeting, just giving you a summary of what it says and what some of the key findings or recommendations in that report are. And then we did receive the Distinguished Budget Award for our fiscal year 16-17 budget from the Government Finance Officers Association. So this is great accolades from them. Great work to our finance staff for receiving this award. And last, Sloan Bailey from Sanitary District 2 was appointed as an alternate commissioner. And I've left a message about getting together and talking about business and the tour. Haven't heard back yet. So.
Okay. Does that cover it?
That's it. Unless you have any questions.
Well, I guess it's probably time for my oral report, which is that I'm going to retire from CMSA, and my plan is that that's at the end of the fiscal year because it seemed like it was tidy. But I was listening, reminded when you were given your various reports, that the budget is, you talked about, you know, June and July, and I'm wondering if it might make more sense to get, I'm assuming it's going to be Dan, to get him in here. His wife had a cow when she heard I was retiring. But anyway, get the new person in here maybe before June. So maybe I should retire sooner. So I'm not sure. I'll have to confer with Dan. I mean, from the standpoint of when it's convenient for him to start.
It'd be great to have you on the finance committee.
It's
still to wrap up the draft budget. We only have 12 meetings planned.
Yeah, right.
For the next 2 months.
How long have you been on this board?
Well, a long time. I have been on, I think, since about, I was listening, you know, I was, did we start doing the food to energy planning work in about 08?
Yeah.
Well, we were fighting with your district on that.
Our district?
About
that. You were fighting with our district on a lot of things.
Well, I know, but that was one of them.
A long time ago.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
No. So I don't know, maybe 07 or 06 or thereabouts.
Call it even 10 years.
I think it's probably 10 years. It doesn't feel like that. But maybe it's been. I don't know. Maybe it's not that long. But I was on it certainly. I was here certainly for a while before I retired from the council, which was in 11, and that was 6 years ago. So.
Really? 6 years ago you retired from the council?
I did. I know. So this sort of, what do you call it, carpetbagger's been, you know, tending to Larkspur's business here on the CMSA all this time.
Important things for the holdover on board members. That's important. We have.
I know. But I love.
They left me on Mira when I left council.
Oh, good.
They didn't want to do it.
Oh,
too much work.
So whenever you decide that it's convenient for you to retire, we'll look to our vice chair to assume the duties. Well, okay.
All right. Okay. Then maybe you can... It's done.
Wait a minute.
Vice chair position will be open.
So, there, anyway, I was asked by Dan. I think we had a really lovely event a month ago for volunteers in Larkspur and all the agencies and schools and so forth. And that's when I went up to Dan and his wife was there, and I said, You do know that I have finally decided when I'm going to pull the cord. My husband's been in the process of retiring for 3.5 years.
I know about that.
So, you know, I just said to him something like, I'll sort of bet you that I can do it first, and we'll see. But I kind of had to, and there it was in front of people. And Dan said, have you told CMSA? I said, well, Jason knows, so I thought it was appropriate to let you know.
Thank you for letting me know.
And I've loved it. It's been really nice to be part of a team of really cooperative and energetic and excited people who look at the opportunities and as a resource agency. And that's such a turnaround from the early days. But I always said that when we started working, you know, and singing Kumbaya at our meetings, then it was okay to leave. That I had to get us to that point.
That is not even kill.
We're really
right after the Pledge of Allegiance.
Kumbaya, yeah. So the next scheduled meeting is Tuesday, May 9th at 7 o'clock. I think I heard a motion to adjourn.
I move.
Second.
Now you have it.
We did. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Well, it's been a little hard to make the